My job takes me to a lot of places. I sleep alone. I eat alone. I'd like to meet someone, but it's tough when you live out of a suitcase. My name's Joe. This is what I do.
Purpose of your visit to Bangkok, Mr. Vincent?
Holiday.
All my clients have one thing in common. They feed off the people. There's big money in misery. Where there's money, there's competition. And the guy paying me usually wins. If you want to make some money,
$2,000 a day. What's your name?
Cobb.
You know the Caribbean Club? Ask for a dancer named Palm. Give her this. She's going to give you a package.
When it comes to killing,
the man in the kiss.
He hurts many country girls. He buys them from their parents and sell them.
Make it quick. Make it clean.
Do the police know who you are?
No one knows who I am.
And never make it personal.
Don't take an interest in people outside of work. There is no such thing as trust.
What is your work?
Oh, banking.
This summer.
This guy fight bad guys and helps the poor. My people love him. He's a very good man, same like you.
When you deal in the business of death, saving a life can be the most deadly job of all.
Yes.
We had an arrangement. Political assassination wasn't in the contract.
Nicolas Cage.
If I see your people again, I'll kill you.
Dangerous.
Hello and welcome to The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike DiCrescia.
How you doing today, Mike?
I am doing well. How are you, Mike?
I am swell, Mike.
Oh, interesting.
It's like well, but just a little essier. Than well is. So today we're talking about a movie that it's almost, I feel like it's a journey that I've taken on to get to this movie, Mike.
I mean, it's 50 episodes.
Yeah, well, yes, okay, it's the journey of the podcast, but I'm talking about a larger journey, like a 10-year journey.
Oh, like a journey through life.
Yes, a journey through life. I'm going to go back in time for a bit. The year was 2008, Mike, and
okay.
We were at the tail end of one of the most, I think, important movie summers of my lifetime. This summer, I had always been way more into movies than the average kid, but this was like the turning point for me. I was 15 years old during this summer, and I went to the movies pretty much every week. This was just what we would do. We would go to the movies after school or whatever on a Friday night, and that would be the thing. Or not after school because it was the summer, but like every Friday night. Every Friday night, we would go to the movies, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
I probably saw just about every major release that year over the span of from May through August. And there were some heavy hitters in there, man. Iron Man and The Dark Knight. Basically wow. Changed blockbuster cinema for a whole decade in that summer. Pixar delivered one of their best, most unique films with WALL-E. I fell in love with Guillermo del Toro that summer with the beautiful, insane world of Hellboy 2, The Golden Army. I snuck into R-rated comedies that I fucking loved, like Step Brothers, Tropic Thunder, and Pineapple Express. I was a born Wachowski defender when I saw Speed Racer, and I was the only one who really dug it. Steven Spielberg released a fourth Indiana Jones movie that was way better than people give it credit for, and... Even the trashy stuff. There was like The Incredible Hulk and Wanted and Hancock. They all had their moments. And I still hold that summer up as perhaps the best movie summer of my lifetime. And I have a ton of memories associated with going to see movies that year. And one of those memories is giggling every time I heard the title, Bangkok Dangerous.
But did you... Here's the question, though. Did you actually see Bangkok Dangerous that year?
I did not.
Got it.
Yeah, the trailer for this movie must have played before every single movie that I saw that summer. And every single time when that title came up, I laughed. Because, A, it sounds like a sex position. Like, hey, baby, I'll give you a Bangkok Dangerous, you know?
Oh, my God.
But, B... And I doubt I was consciously thinking about this. It just makes no sense as a title, unless the character Cage plays is actually named Bangkok Dangerous, which he should have been.
That would have been amazing.
Alas, he is not. It's just Joe. Really, this movie should be called Bangkok is dangerous, because that's a grammatically correct
true.
But I did not end up seeing Bangkok Dangerous in the theater. I just have those memories associated with watching that trailer over and over again. It was released in September when school had just about started, and also I didn't care that much about it. It was just a goofy looking movie that I saw trailers for a long time. But the name has always stuck with me. Years later, I still like occasionally made jokes about the title Bangkok Dangerous. And now, 10 years later, I have finally seen the movie.
Yeah. You've come full circle.
Yeah, so when I'm saying this is a journey for me, Mike, I feel like it actually, it does feel like the logical endpoint to 10 years of Bangkok Dangerous jokes.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Mike, I'm happy for you. You've made it this far. You've done it.
Yeah, we can hang out the podcast right now. We don't have to do
yeah. the last whoever needs to see another movie again.
Now, Bangkok Dangerous is actually a remake of a 1990 film from, or 1999 film from Thailand, which is also called Bangkok Dangerous. But what sets it apart from most other English language remakes of foreign films is it's actually written and directed by the same guys who made the original. They're called the Pang Brothers, Danny Pang and Oxide Pang. And the original was their feature debut and got some critical notice, winning an award at the Toronto International Film Festival and getting nominated for Best Film and Best Editing at the Thailand National Film Association Awards. And they followed that movie up with a horror film called The Eye, which coincidentally enough also got an American remake in 2008 with Jessica Alba, if you remember that horror
movie. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was a remake of a Pang Brothers film, although they were not involved with that one. They spent all their energy on Bangkok Dangerous. Yeah. So now
spoilers.
Yeah. Now directors remaking their own films, that's unusual, but it does occasionally happen. Alfred Hitchcock has two versions of The Man Who Knew Too Much. And Michael Haneke directed an American remake of his own Funny Games. But Cage's production company, Saturn Films, actually purchased the remake rights and hired the Pangs to return to direct. And they began filming in Bangkok in 2006 under the working title Big Hit in Bangkok. Now, that's a title. I wish it was.
That is.
I mean, I'm glad that this movie is called Bangkok Dangerous because it has provided me with much amusement over the years. But Big Hit in Bangkok is a better title for the movie.
It also sounds like it would have come out 30 years earlier and have been directed by John Carpenter's Two on the Nose. But
you're thinking of Big Trouble in Little China. And I
respect yeah,
it. At one point, though, the movie was also known as Time to Kill, which is weird because Nicolas Cage also once starred in the Italian film Tempo di Uccidere, a.k.a. Time to Kill, right?
Does this count as a Cage reunion for an entire movie?
A Cage reunion with himself
yes.
for a movie? Yes. Yeah, we'll count it. There it is. Now, there is one key difference between this film and the original Bangkok Dangerous. In this movie, Cage is a hitman who romances a woman who happens to be a deaf mute. In the original, the hitman is actually the deaf mute. And that disability is actually what makes him a fearless, unflinching gunman. And Oxide Pang, one of the co-directors, was very open about the fact that the change was made for marketing purposes, saying they needed to give Cage some lines to sell the movie. That's literally all there is to it. So they changed the girlfriend into a deaf mute to maintain the drama of communication between the two characters. Which makes sense. That's a decent way to go about it, I guess, if you have to change the fact that Cage has to talk. Now, Nicolas Cage stars in the movie as Joe, an assassin. He trains a guy named Kong, played by Shakrit Yamnarm, and his girlfriend Fawn is played by Charlie Young, who art house cinema fans may know from a couple of films by director Wong Kar-wai, like Ashes of Time and Fallen Angels. Niritasai Kalajurek, I'm probably...
Crushed it. Oh, yeah. That was right.
That was right.
That was it.
plays the villain Surat. Panward Hemini plays Kong's girlfriend Aum. And Peter Shadrin plays Anton, who I believe is Surat's henchman, who looks like Spike from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Got it.
So the movie was written and directed by the Pang brothers just 1 year after they made the horror film The Messengers, which starred Kristen Stewart before she was in Twilight and was produced by Sam Raimi. Yeah, that kind of sounds intriguing, right? And 1 year before their 2009 film The Storm Warriors, which was a Hong Kong fantasy movie. The film did not do particularly well at the box office. That title may have had something to do with it. took in $42 million against a budget of $45 million, and it's also got very bad reviews, and currently holds a 9% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Nine? Like 0.9.
Like single digits 9. Yes, 9%. Wow. And it was released on September 5th, 2008, and it was the only movie that was released that day.
Struggle.
Yeah, struggle is real. The IMDb plot synopsis for Bangkok Dangerous reads, a hitman who's in Bangkok to pull off a series of jobs violates his personal code when he falls for a local woman and bonds with his errand boy. So, Mike, we talked about the background of Bangkok Dangerous a bit, the Bangkok ground of Bangkok background Dangerous, whatever you however you want to describe it. The first way was probably the better way.
Yeah, that was good.
What are your overall thoughts on Bangkok Dangerous?
My overall thoughts is that this is a movie that's trying to do a thing. I feel like there are moments, and I mean like literal moments, yeah. That are cool, and I was like, yeah, I'm in. And then there's the other like 118 minutes or whatever. Whatever it is, I don't think it's not 2 hours long.
That's an hour 40 minutes,
and that's a shame. I felt I was kind of like sad for this movie, especially since it's the same guys coming back to like you know kind of redo their own movie and make it big in America. It seems you know like that's kind of like the point. It seems like to break right. into the American Hollywood, you know.
Sure,
but it's being let down by so much other stuff in itself. The story doesn't really kind of do anything. There's the whole like cage romance feels real weird.
Because
it's like, hey, you helped me in a store. We're in love now. and that's kind of it. But yeah, it's just an odd movie in some way, and not like interesting odd, just odd.
Yeah, I think it's a good way to describe it. Not interesting, odd, just odd. I do think it is a slightly better movie than its reputation suggests.
Yeah.
And it's not good, and it's borderline nonsensical, and it's sometimes unintentionally funny. But the action, I think, is all pretty solid. Like, there's some pretty good action scenes in this movie, and they kind of, like, helped me get through it, you know? There are two sequences that I think are actually a ton of fun, and I'll talk about them when I talk about the moments that stood out to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think this movie, like you said, it's interesting. More interesting, I think, as a place in Cage's career, right? Because we talked about this during the National Treasure Book of Secrets review, how that movie is kind of, like, the last big hit for Nicolas Cage. And the rest of the, and like now we're getting into the decline. I think this is like kind of the first of several movies that were made, because he was, you know, behind on his taxes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Make some money real quick. And I think he really pushes himself in this movie in different ways than he had done in previous films that he's made. But I don't think it necessarily works most of the time. But I do want to give this movie a little bit of props. It is rare that an American movie features a whole cast of Asian actors so prominently.
Yeah, that's true.
So I do think it's somewhat notable. It's kind of like, that's kind of neat. But what did you think of Nicolas Cage in the movie, Mike? Nicolas Cage plays Joe, this kind of hitman, sort of a stoic badass here. Like, what was your take on Cage?
Yeah, this is also the beginning of the era of bad hair Cage, right? Yeah,
I think Next is really the one that...
Yeah, that's true.
Really jump-started Bad Hair Cage, but this cements it. This is like,
yeah, I think it stands out as being the post National Treasure Book of Secrets, like that era of you know that chapter of Cage is also so heavily defined by his bad hair.
Yeah,
in my mind and the meme of Nicolas Cage.
Sure.
You know, I think maybe we've tracked the era of weird voice Cage and we've brought it up, and I think now we're going to be entering every movie we'll be talking about his hair, maybe.
It's
just pick another arbitrary thing we could talk about him.
Yeah.
But I think Cage is turning in a decent performance. That's not how you say that word. Performance of, you know, that kind of grizzled old, just one last job kind of thing. But that also kind of deters from the movie because that's so tropey. That hurts the story so much, in my opinion, where we've seen it so many times and this isn't doing anything original with that type of character or that type of story.
Yeah.
So to just see Cage kind of, I don't want to say going through the motions because he's not phoning it in yet, I don't think. But that's, you can see that on the horizon. The glimmer of that performance is coming. What about you, Mike?
I mean, I think it takes a little while to get used to Nicolas Cage in this movie, you know, because he's asked to play the stoic badass here.
Right.
And I think that plays kind of against his strengths. You know, I think Cage is best in action roles when he's at least a little quirky. You know? And this movie has no quirk. There's no quirk to Bangkok Dangerous, which is ridiculous because it's a movie called Bangkok Dangerous. Like, But I do think by the end of it, he sells that badassness pretty well. Like the, you know, it takes some time to get into what he's doing in the role, but at a certain point, it kind of starts working. But I could very much have done without the voiceover in the movie. I think that's honestly, my biggest complaint about the movie is that Cage's voiceover is just constant. It's constantly going. That to me, I feel like he's checked out of the voiceover. You know what I mean? It's a very flat reading of the voiceover. And it kind of just lulls you into a, I honestly, I feel like I tuned out most of the stuff he said in the voiceover because I just did not care. There's nothing in the voiceover performance that made me into what he was saying. And it's unlike, we've talked about Cage voiceover in the past. You know, he does a great job in adaptation for his voiceover stuff. And The Weatherman is a lot of good stuff in there. But then we talked about Lord of War, where it's just there's way too much voiceover in this movie. And he's not delivering it as dynamically as maybe he could. And I think this kind of falls into that category. This play is like Harrison Ford in the original cut of Blade Runner. You know, just the really disaffected voiceover. And I think it's kind of interesting because, the original movie, the character is a deaf mute. And in this one, he just doesn't shut up.
Oh, my God. I never even thought of that. That's amazing.
He's just constantly talking. And, I have not seen the original movie, but I feel like if I could watch this American movie without the voiceover, I might like it a lot more.
Yeah, that'd be pretty interesting. Yeah, and it is interesting too because this movie feels sort of like a proto John Wick kind of type thing.
Yeah,
right. Like
towards the end.
Yeah, well, definitely. Yeah, that's where it really stood out to me. But it's interesting to see this kind of action movie again, right? Or maybe not again is not the right word, but in the decade before where every action movie that features this kind of assassin-y character is now this kind of gritty, realistic version of that kind of character, Atomic Blonde and, those kind of things, those types of fight choreography and stuff. So it's funny to see Cage doing that with none of the training and none of the choreography and the things that make that kind of movie so good.
I can definitely see that. So how do you think this role fits into the roles that we've seen Nicolas Cage play in other movies, Mike? Is there anything – I don't think he's ever played an assassin before, so it's kind of new for him.
No, but it's kind of the tail end of action star Cage, right? He had we Made It My trilogy and all that stuff. And we saw the family action star in the National Treasure movies. And he's playing the kind of – the grumpy old assassin action star type thing. But even that, there seems like there's not much action happening.
I think this is more of a crime thriller really than an action movie, but it's kind of built around its action set pieces, if that makes sense.
I don't know. There's nothing that super jumps out to me as far other than it being a kind of, action quote unquote, leading role.
Yeah. Well, when you say he's we're seeing Nicolas Cage not being an action star anymore. He will be in a lot more action movies, I think. From this point forward, but they're not going to be ones you know.
In terms of box office blockbuster kind of
stream. Yeah, he's kind of leaving the action world behind. But he's definitely in the direct DVD action stuff quite a bit. I will say, much like The Wicker Man, this movie is a remake with one key change that differentiates from the original. Right, in The Wicker Man, they changed the island to all women, and in this one, they changed Cage's character to be able to talk and changed the girlfriend to a deaf mute. Also, there's a lot of scenes of Cage on a motorcycle in this movie that felt like it could have been unused Ghost Rider footage. just they didn't finish the effects, and they're like, well, just toss in Bangkok Dangerous, it's fine.
Yeah, nobody will notice.
Were there any moments or scenes that stood out to you in Bangkok Dangerous, Mike? Is there anything you wanted to highlight?
Yeah, there's a couple scenes that I think, I had mentioned earlier, there's some really cool moments and there's some interesting things happening in terms of cinematography and stuff like that. There's one scene where Kong, towards the beginning, on his first, or not his first errand, maybe, but he gets jumped while he's carrying a briefcase.
Yeah.
And it, results in a really quick foot chase. And, it's like a handheld camera chased down an alleyway with, this really cool stuff going, twists and turns, and some cool action cinematography things happening in that, 25-second foot chase that I was like, hell yeah, I'm in. This is it. We're doing it. Oh, it's over. Yeah. So stuff like that. What about you? What jumps out to you?
Well, I mean, you mentioned Kong. I do think Cage's relationship with Kong kind of interesting because, the movie begins with Cage, you know, outlining these like four rules, right, that he has, you know, for his hitman lifestyle.
Right.
And it's weird that, it kind of just, he's like, all right, I have four rules. And I barely even remember what they were. It was like, know when to get out and like, don't get too close, something like that. And the way he introduces them, like just so nonchalantly, it's like, I was taking notes and I'm like, I almost wanted to like raise my hand. It's like, is this going to be on the test like afterwards or something? Like, I'm not supposed to know this. But then as soon as he introduces those rules, he immediately starts breaking them for no reason.
Just completely disregards them. Yeah.
Just completely disregards the rules. So Cage kind of befriends this Kong guy, and he starts training him, and it kind of has like an echo of Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid, where he's like kind of teaching him these different hitman techniques. And
it's just such a dumb sentence.
And the first half of the movie is basically just a series of montages. Like it's very Rocky IV, where it's just like montage every 5 minutes. But it's really heavily influenced by The Karate Kid and also The Matrix. I feel like there's a little bit of Matrix influence happening there. They even have there's a part where he and Kong are like in the city, like and he's trying to teach him how to like walk around the city and spot things. And there's even like a Matrix scenario where they're in the crowded city and it involves someone wearing a vibrant red color.
Yeah. Yep.
It's like this is just the Matrix. I'm watching the Matrix, but worse. And
that's a good point. I also think there's a scene the kind of oh wait, did I cut you off? Did you finish where you were going with Kong?
Yeah. What were you gonna say?
No, I was gonna say I was gonna point out the kind of the failed assassination attempt on the river market or the floating market kind of
thing.
You're
talking about the boat chase.
The boat chase, yeah.
Okay, yeah. This was probably my favorite scene in the movie, actually. Because I think, you know, I'm always down for a good boat chase.
Who's not?
And I don't think this is as good as the boat chase in Face Off. You know, because Face Off has one of the best boat chases of all time. But it does feature Nicolas Cage jumping from a motorcycle to a boat, you know?
Yeah.
And his, like, kind of pelvis hitting the boat as he's...
Yeah, that looks like it hurt real bad.
So I dug it. I was in on that boat chase. Also, like, the propeller chops the dude's hand off, and then Cage kills him, and it's awesome.
Yeah, like, with his own hand. Well, sort of.
Yeah. So you wanted to bring that up, Mike. Did you have anything else you wanted to mention other than the boat chase was cool, or, like...
Well, I thought that's another one of the moments where there is, like, interesting action movie, like, cinematography and film technique happening. Like, the camera mounted on the front of the motorcycle looking up at Cage while he's, you know, driving and shooting. And when he gets on the boat and he takes the gun out of the guy's severed hand, and he shoots him, and the camera goes underneath the boat, and we always see is the bullets coming through the bottom of the boat, and then the blood, you know, into the river. Like, that's some really cool shit happening, and that's like some clever and unique film stuff. But then, like, that's the movie. Those moments are so let down by the whole rest of the movie to me.
Yeah, because that's the thing. I feel like this movie really comes alive during its action sequences. And the rest of the movie is just a nothing. It's nothing. Like, there's nothing going on.
<There's>, no.
Nothing of value anyway. Like, it's just kind of like Cage, you know, he's falling in love and whatever. Also, I like, we talked, what do you think of the relationship between Cage and Fawn? I think her name was Fenn or something like that.
Oh, the girl, the mute.
The deaf mute girl, yeah.
Yeah. Real weird, like I said, because it kind of just comes out of nowhere, and it's so, like, I mean, I guess it's not trying to be subtle about it, right? Like, it's just, as soon as he sees her, you know, as soon as she appears on screen, you're like, oh, this, we're gonna do this. Okay. And it's fine. Like, I guess it allows for him to have some emotional stakes in some way, like, it's just because they have to be there, is sort of how I felt.
That's kind of, yeah, that's kind of what it's there for.
Yeah, and there is one, it does allow for one cool action scene for a half a second when they're in the park and she walks away.
That is the funniest moment in the entire movie. This girl that he's dating, she's deaf and mute, obviously, so she hands him a love note, and she says, like, I'm so happy to be with you, something along those lines, in the note. And then she hands it to him, and she, like, walks a few paces ahead, and the camera is focused entirely on her, like, in the foreground, and in the background you see Cage. And in the background, these two guys just, like, swarm him, and Cage just annihilates them, he, like, shoots them in the head, and it's awesome. While she's still in the camera frame, and she's just, like, kind of, like, looking lovingly into the distance.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
She can't hear what's going on behind her because she's deaf. And then when she finally turns around, she sees the dead bodies and she freaks out. And it's hilarious. And
It's tragic, but also like kind of cool. Like because the sound cuts out, it was muffled, sort of. Right. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was.
I think it might have been trying to be played as like tragic, but it just came off as really funny to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, and I wanted to talk about like the big final shootout too in the warehouse. Because that I think is like, I mean, I talked about the boat chase, probably my favorite scene in the movie, but I think this is like, Cage unleashed, like the unleashed badass Cage is, during this final shootout. He's picking dudes off left and right. It's his own little John Wick. And it also features the, Spike from Buffy the Vampire Slayer lookalike, getting blown in half with a grenade, which is fun. There's a cool looking, like flashing red light that happens, throughout that, you know, fight, which is cool. And I enjoyed the bit with Cage and the other guys shooting through water jugs.
Just blow up a bunch of water. It'll look cool. That's what they do.
Yeah, it was just so extraneous and so like, oh, you just aim a little higher and you could be missing the water jug. But it was fine. Like, water was exploding. And it was also, like, in the last movie we talked about, National Treasure 2, beer kegs played a significant role in a set piece. So I don't know why.
So it's a Cage reunion.
I don't know why this is important, but it feels important to me. I want the next movie that we talk about to have some kind of like, you know, a Snapple machine that goes off the rails or something. Like,
we'll have another trilogy, the We Made It My trilogy, the Something Man trilogy, and we'll workshop this new trilogy,
Exploding Drinks trilogy. Anyway, yeah, other stuff. I mean, there's a bit with an elephant in this movie, which is weird.
Yeah. I felt like that was some kind of, you know, that's an aspect of Thai, right? Bangkok?
Thailand.
Culture. That, man, that was embarrassing. you know, that I am not privy to or I'm not familiar with, the importance of elephant and elephant imagery, I guess. Because Kong makes a reference to the trunk is facing the wrong way in the painting and... You know, but that was also very odd, where it just appears in like a market.
Yeah. Seems like it was a trained elephant, I assume. It might not just be a wild elephant, wandering around, but like it happens twice. Like, you see the elephant in the market and then later Cage is like walking around and he sees the elephant again. And he has like that kind of like moment of like wonder looking at the elephant. And it's like in this moment, Cage sees all the beauty in the world because of this elephant.
It's just chilling.
Just chilling. Just chilling. Yeah. And, I actually do want to mention about the boat chase one more time. There's a little bit of the score. Like, I don't know if you noticed the score. It was very subtle. I swear to God, I heard a little bit of the score from Uncharted during the boat chase.
Are we just always going to bring up Uncharted now?
I didn't want to bring it up, Mike. But
the movie made you.
The movie made me. I swear to God, I heard, like, it was just a little bit. It was, you know, that little, like, whenever you find, like, a treasure in Uncharted, you hear that, like, whom, like,
oh my God.
That plays there. I heard that in the boat chase, and I was like, what is this?
What treasure have I found?
What treasure have I found? This was a year after the first Uncharted game came out, so it's you know, potentially, like, maybe there's like a Sony connection somewhere that I didn't notice. Here it's Lionsgate actually, which I think Sony owns. So it's quite possible they just like, you know, grabbed a little Uncharted piece there.
Yeah,
which is interesting. But anyway, yeah. And finally, I did want to talk about the ending of this movie, Mike.
Okay.
When after the big warehouse fight, Cage kills himself. And Surratt, the villain, in the end.
Yes.
Which is fine. You know, his arc is that he's gone from someone without feelings to someone with feelings, basically. But there's never really any reason why he breaks his four rules. He just kind of does. So the ending falls pretty flat to me.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that there's also a much happier alternate ending, which came out in the film's DVD release.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess they shot two endings, and they went with the ballsier one, I guess, for the theatrical, which is interesting.
Okay.
But for the alternate ending in the... a DVD release. I'll read you the Wikipedia summary. An alternate ending to the theatrical version shows that before Joe kills himself in the original version, Kong steals a police car and comes to the rescue. He kills Surratt and runs the stolen car, although he is shot once in the arm. After eluding the police officers, they hide in a neighborhood a few meters away from Surratt's headquarters. As locals come out to investigate the commotion, Kong reveals that Joe is the man who killed Surratt. They help him recuperate, while one local remarks that Surratt was a very bad man, adding that his death marks an end to his crimes and atrocities in their place, with the words, "It's good that he is dead." Kong then takes Joe to a boatman and gives him passports so that he may flee the country. Joe thanks Kong for his assistance and gives him a bank account number with a bonus, saying that he is a good student. Joe then departs with the camera focused on Kong from Joe's perspective, similar to the original ending. So yeah, it's you know, in that ending, you know, Surratt dies, but Cage gets away, and, he gets to leave the country and Kong gets a lot of money. And that's basically the alternate ending. So do you think that would have played better for you in this movie than the theatrical ending where Cage dies?
Probably, based solely on the lack of any kind of caring about Joe. Right, like, because that big powerful moment where he kills himself with and shoots Surratt at the same time, like through his own head and all that stuff. I'm just like, K.
Right,
there's no emotional punch.
You would have rather had this like big heroic moment where Kong comes in and saves the day and like becomes like the new hitman, sort of like.
Because I think that would have been at least more fun, right? See him training and going through all this stuff through most of the movie is just that kind of, and he doesn't really do anything. we got to see him do that whole, you know, save the teacher, you know, save his own master kind of thing. That would have been cool, I think.
Yeah, you're right. I think that might have been more fun too. But I appreciate this ending. Like, I feel like I respect the intent behind it. It just feels like there should have been a lot more going on in the movie to let that ending work.
How close did this come out to The Mist? Because I wonder how much that ending influenced movies. End of movies.
I want to say The Mist came out in like 2007, so it was about a year before. You might be on something, Mike.
Maybe. I don't know.
I do want to talk about one scene that isn't in the movie, Mike. Because you
can, interesting.
Because you brought it up. Before we did this review, I think you might have mentioned it in our last Complete Works. There's a line in the movie. There's a line that you thought was in the movie.
Yeah.
And you thought there's a line where Nicolas Cage says, "It sure is dangerous here in Bangkok."
Yeah. Or I hoped. I really hoped that was a line in this movie.
Can you give me some why did you think that line would be in this movie?
Yeah, so one of my friends from college, I don't know, I honestly don't know the context or don't know why this became a thing that we would say, but one of my friends would say, "It sure is dangerous here in Bangkok." I was like, "What?" And he was like, "Oh, Bangkok dangerous." And I was like, "Oh, that's a thing? Holy shit." And like, I just kind of assumed it was from the movie and that it just became like a refrain, like a dumb thing, like, "Oh, we're drunk." And we would be like, "Oh, it sure is dangerous here in Bangkok." We'd all laugh and be dumb. So when we got to this movie, I was really hoping that might, you know, I would have my own journey that would mirror yours, the same emotional punch. The same hero's arc.
Yeah. To be fair, there's a similar line towards the beginning when Cage is introducing the movie and he's like, "Bangkok, it's a dirty, like, corrupt city," or whatever. But it's not the same. Yeah. It's not the same, you know. Like,
this is the moment. Oh.
Yeah, which is a bummer. I wish, like, because you mentioned that line like last time and I was like, I really hope that's an actual line of dialogue in the movie, because that would be hilarious. But I love the fact that, you know, Bangkok Dangerous has had, like, at least a small impact on our lives in the past. You know what I mean? Like, neither of us had seen the movie, right? And so, like, but we still made jokes about it years after it came out. And
never seen it.
And I think that's worth something. At the end of the day, you know, there have been a lot of movies that we've reviewed that are just plain forgettable. Like, we don't reference Trapped in Paradise ever. You know what I mean?
No.
But
this might have been the only other time we've talked about Tempo di Uccidere.
Exactly. Unless you want to bring up the uncomfortable rape scene, in which case,
never mind.
I feel like there is some kind of significance in the fact that Bangkok Dangerous, even though we had never seen it, had some kind of impact on our lives. You know, it's worth talking about just for that reason.
Yeah.
Right?
It's more culturally relevant than Avatar.
Sure. Yeah. Let's go with that.
And I think
And I think we can wrap up our thoughts on Bangkok Dangerous on that sentiment.
That's the episode description for this one.
Bangkok Dangerous, more culturally relevant than Avatar. Discuss.
Don't at me.
Yeah. So, but now, Mike, I think we should move on. Let's get into some reviews from the popular peoples. So I got some Netflix reviews. I also got some Letterboxd reviews. I wanted to mix it up a little bit. I want to start grabbing reviews from different sources. So first we'll start with some Netflix reviews. Here's a 5-star review of Bangkok Dangerous. "The review I read was written by someone who never met killers."
That's a strong start.
Yeah. Cage was quite believable. You can't get away from the honey trap, which is actually emotions, not physical relationships. If you haven't trained not to fall for it and you do so, even partially, there will be some very, very strange things happening. This was a good representation of what those strange things result in. Pardon all the bad grammar, but good grammar is hard to read generally. What? Incidentally, not a one of them regretted it, although all had presumably left the trade, whether it was military or post-military. So from the killer's POV, this is a pretty good movie, Mike.
Yeah.
It's considered. Do you think this guy actually knows contract killers versus saying that on Netflix to look cool?
That seemed, yeah, that'd be a really bold claim to make on an account that's linked to all your personal information and stuff.
But you know, at the same time, do you think the FBI is looking at reviews of Bangkok Dangerous on Netflix?
You know, they're looking where you least expect it, right?
I guess that's true. Here's a 1-star review of Bangkok Dangerous. Usually a big fan of Nicolas Cage, but this movie was downright terrible. Had to force myself to watch the whole thing twice to see if I was missing something that redeemed it. I will never get those 198 minutes of my life back. Why did you watch it twice?
That's impressive.
Yeah. Like this is the thing. You get a disc from Netflix, right? So you only have it for like a short amount of time before you send it back. I mean, you can have it as long as you want, but like ideally you want to send it back so you can get another disc from Netflix. Right. This guy watched it once, decided it was terrible, then watched it again before he sent the disc back.
It's like, it couldn't possibly have been that bad. Let me check again.
Yeah, what is your thought process there? It's still going to be bad if you watch it an hour later.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? All right, here's a 4-star review of Bangkok Dangerous. This is the best Nick Cage movie to date. If anyone wants to see real life, one needs to step away from the TV. Nick Cage is the star of the movie. Nick Cage did a good job. He provided a few minutes of pleasure for me, and he paid some of his bills. A win-win for all.
Did Nick Cage write this review?
He definitely said his name a whole bunch, and he's pretty happy that he paid off some debts. So yeah, I mean, or this guy's just really concerned with Nick Cage's bills. You know, you never know.
Who's not? You know,
that's true. Yeah, I mean, the dude has like 6 houses. You know, but in any case, here's a 3-star review of Bangkok Dangerous. Another meh movie. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't great. I was expecting more action. I've also noticed that Nick has a greasy, receding hairline look going on, which doesn't sit well with me. His acting is going down the tubes. Like he's not putting his all into his roles anymore. I kind of notice it in Ghost Rider and Knowing too. It pains me to say these things about him since I know he can act, like The Rock in Raising Arizona. Not to mention, I have a lot of respect for him as a fellow Superman fan. I mean, he even named his kid Kal-El. That's a fan. That's Superman's Kryptonian name, for those who don't know.
Jesus.
Anyway, it wasn't bad, like I said, but there were missing elements that could have made it better, and things that could have been left out, like him trying to date a deaf girl. The ending was also disappointing. It just ended weird. I can't explain without giving anything away, and I'm not into giving spoilers. I hope that once I see The Sorcerer's Apprentice that Nick will actually act and do a good job, and that Alfred Molina will be as good as he was in Spider-Man 2.
Oh, no. That sweet summer child.
Oh man, he's in for something.
Yeah.
Anyway, now we're gonna move on to Letterboxd reviews. I got 2 of these. Here's a 3-star review from Letterboxd. Nick Cage plays a badass hitman guy named Joe who's working in Bangkok. Joe enjoys wearing leather outfits and has the silky soft hair of a Chinaman.
Jesus.
He has all these rules that he lives by. 1, don't ask questions. 2, don't take an interest in people outside of work. 3, erase every trace. 4, know when to get out. 5, don't talk about Fight Club. Whoops, my bad. for no apparent reason, Nick Cage decides to start breaking all these rules that have worked so well for him. It starts when he takes some pickpocket dude under his wing and becomes his teacher. There's a pretty silly training montage that follows where Joe displays some of his martial arts skills, his ability to shoot watermelon, and his perfect push-up form. Then he meets a deaf nurse after he gets a scrape on his arm. They fall for each other pretty quick, despite the language and sound barrier. This is followed by one of the most unintentionally funny scenes in cinema, where her and Joe go on a dinner date and Joe can't handle the spicy food.
Oh my god.
That is a pretty good scene. That is pretty
funny. Forgot about that. Yeah.
That scene really showed Joe's sensitive side. These nice scenes are sandwiched in between various scenes where Joe is brutally murdering peeps. Now I'm not going to bullshit you. This is an utterly ridiculous movie that would have been a one star had it not been for the inclusion of Nicolas Cage. Because of Cage, however, it's no longer a bad movie. It is a Nicolas Cage movie, which gets rated on a different scale. Nicolas Cage has the odd ability to turn movies from shitty to amazing. No matter how bad or ridiculous a movie is, Nick Cage puts 110% into that role, and that's a magical thing. Nick Cage fans know what I'm talking about. If you understand the magic of Nicolas Cage, you're going to want to see this gem. And I feel like that last paragraph is the thesis statement for this entire podcast.
Yeah. You put it much – they put it much more eloquently than I could have ever.
than we have done in 51 episodes of this podcast.
Mm-hmm. So shout out to our new producer that wrote that review.
You're hired. Now we got one last one. Here's a two-star review of Bangkok Dangerous from Letterboxd. Yesterday, I had the pleasure of attending a Nick Cage marathon at my local Alamo Drafthouse. I knew I was in for one hell of a day, but none of us predicted that Nick Cage himself picked the five movies we were going to watch. And we really did not think Nick Cage would show up, but he did. And he watched five of his own movies with us, and the first one was Bangkok Dangerous.
Oh my god.
Originally, I was shocked that he picked Bangkok Dangerous out of all of his films. I was also wildly distracted because he sat two rows in front of me, so I could just see him watching himself. It was a very odd experience. But the movie was kind of fun. It's dumb and has its moments here and there. Is it his best? No. But did it deserve the beating it took upon release? No. So thanks, Nick. I'm glad you picked Bangkok Dangerous. And more than anything, I was very excited to see his reaction to the films and see that he was truly proud of it. Made for one hell of an experience. And I like that review. It's just, like, Cage is like really into this movie, apparently.
that's great.
Yeah. That was a Cage. That was, I think, last year at the Alamo Drafthouse in Texas. That Drafthouse does a Nicolas Cage marathon every year. I think that was its fourth one. And that year, Cage actually programmed the marathon. So I think he chose Bangkok Dangerous. Bringing Out the Dead was definitely a movie that he chose. Joe, which we haven't talked about yet, but that was definitely one of them. And there was one or two others, and I'm blanking on what they are. But they were kind of like off the wall, like picks that you wouldn't expect to see in this kind of marathon. Stuff that, it's not like The Rock, and it's not Face Off and stuff like that. More off-kilter picks from Nicolas Cage. And I think that's interesting, for sure. But I also think, like, the fact that he's, he chose Bangkok Dangerous, this movie that has a 9% of Rotten Tomatoes. But that he's clearly very proud of, and I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. And I think that that about wraps it up for today, Mike, right? So, Bangkok Dangerous, it's, it's not good, right?
No. No, definitely not.
But it's certainly, I think, watchable. And it has some decent action scenes, so... that is our review of Bangkok Dangerous. The 10 years in the making, this review, really. At least for me and for you as well. So where can we find you online this week, Mike?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog. All of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Plus, you can check out some of my work at frickinmarquee.com. I do some stuff there. Thank you so much for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, rate it, subscribe, take a moment to give us a review. Help support this podcast and Filmbook. Take part in our Patreon campaign. You can find our Patreon campaign page at patreon.com/filmbook. Now, any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email because we produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now, join us in 2 weeks for another episode of The Complete Works. And Mike, I don't know if you know what movie is coming up next.
I don't.
Oh, man. Let's just say it's one that you have been waiting and waiting for. We will be talking to Nicolas Cage in 2009's Knowing.
Mother of God. Now, something came up that day. Can't ever record this podcast again.
we haven't set a date to record that one yet. You realize that, right?
Nope.
Yeah, so I've never seen Knowing, actually, and I am eager to check it out. Everybody I know who's seen Knowing absolutely hates it. So I think I might like it. I don't. I'm eager to watch Knowing and see like this kind of misunderstood masterpiece that no one else sees.
Yeah, it'll be the speed racer of this podcast.
Hey man, Speed Racer is gaining a cult following. It is real good. You gotta watch it. Have you seen Speed Racer?
Probably. I don't remember.
it's a lot of fun, man. It's Wachowski.
All right.
Wachowski's just going full on nuts. It's like a live action anime. And it's like, it's bananas. Watch Speed Racer. But also watch Knowing if you want to listen to our podcast.
Yeah. Or Colin, don't you dare text me about this movie. He's the one that made me watch it, and I've never let him live it down.
Oh, really? Okay. So this is this is going to be a fun one. Yeah. So that's definitely our next episode of Complete Works. Plus, keep an eye out for Film Bookcast, where we don't know what we're doing next, but we will find out at some point.
And you'll find out right there with us.
Exactly. So thank you so much for listening, guys, and thanks for getting in the cage.
Declaration of Independence gone in 60 seconds, cause we're down to business, a national treasure. He's my rock, 8 foot tall with a 9 foot cock. Bangkok dangerous, he might drive angry, set the screen on fire, just like Big Daddy. Don't be hating, he's an Oscar winner, eats bitches for lunch and more bitches for dinner. Ooh, Nick Cage, motherfucker.